Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking in urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome to this event, an in-conversation event with my guest, Ben Houchin, who is the Mayor of Tees Valley. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks, Andrew.
So I think the format is, I'm sure Ben's got some things that he wants to talk about. There's a couple of things I want to talk to you about, get your views on not only what's going on in your part of the world, but also how you see the kind of broader agenda that you're part of. What would you want of it? You know, in a sense, we know that there are things on the horizon in terms of the white paper and you know, related activities. So it'd be good to get your kind of thoughts on that as well. And then we'll open it up for questions from you as well. So have a think about the kind of questions that you want to put to Ben, and we'll be done by 4:30. So I suppose the first question, Ben, is enjoying being a mayor?
Yeah, love it.
What's good about it? Because you were a councillor in Stockton for 6 years, is that right? Before
11 to 17? Yeah, so 2011 to 17. Yeah.
So you were kind of councillor.
Good
there.
Research, Andrew.
Always know who you're talking to. So you did that, and then obviously mayoralty came along, put your hat in the ring. Did you think you were going to win?
It depends on what time frame you talk about. So I was involved quite heavily with James Wharton's re-election campaign in 2015. Thought about standing for Parliament, decided not to. I didn't really think it was for me at the time. But then devolution came about, you know, the whole Northern Powerhouse regional agenda with Cameron and Osborne. And, fate would have it that a couple of things happened. One very negative thing, one very positive thing. The very negative being the closure of the steelworks in 2015, which created an issue that the government had to address. Obviously, Heseltine came in and looked at the review of somewhere like Teesside and the local economy. And the big positive, post-2015 and his re-election, was James Wharton being the original Northern Powerhouse Minister, who was charged with helping George deliver the devolution deals, of which, and rightly so, given it was the very first deal, George very much concentrating on the Greater Manchester deal as the most complete deal. Yeah. And we had an unsung champion, but a quiet story in that James Wharton basically walked into George and said that he wanted a deal for the Tees Valley. Wasn't really much interest from Treasury or government in the Tees Valley at the time, and he was said, you can get yourself a deal if you can get the councils to work together and we'll support you, but we've got other bigger fish to fry, which again at the time I suppose you can appreciate. And James ended up working with what were 5 Labour councils at the time to make it happen. So it kind of organically grew quite late in the day. I mean, it was always signposted, wasn't it, Manchester was going to get a deal for a long time. But the legislation wasn't passed until the December or maybe the November. So I was only selected as a candidate in December of 2016, so 5 months before the election. And I did it because, I started running my own business, was a councillor, leader of the Conservative group at the time on Stockton Council. And I thought, well, if you ever want to be in politics, you can't pass up the chance for standing on what is quite an interesting platform in your own home patch. Yeah. And to be fair, I worked with James quite heavily and we said, well, look, we'll give it a go, we'll have a bit of fun, we'll give Labour a black eye, cause them a bit of a headache, and what will be. So, to answer your question in that context, the day I was selected, no, I didn't think I was going to win. I thought we'd give it a good go and we'd cause a problem for the local Labour Party going up to the next general election, give them a few things to cause a headache, including the airport pledge, which was all kind of, one, to demonstrate what mayors can do, but two, it's actually a fundamental problem, and a very parochial one, but a fundamental problem with infrastructure and connectivity in the Tees Valley. But as you got closer to the election, so come end of February, beginning of March time, there was an interesting sense that, hang on, things aren't how they usually go in elections in Teesside. Yeah. So to signal my genuine thought that it was a possibility, was when I was running my own business, I ended up having to come to an arrangement with my business partner to set up me exiting the business if I was to win. So we had that all in place. So the day I was elected, I actually signed the papers and handed the business over and exited that business because we had it set up, because there was a possibility. And when you got to a week before, I mean, in all honesty, from a political standpoint, it felt like we'd already won, because either our run Labour as close as they've ever been run before on that type of election, or we actually win.
Yeah.
And then walking into the count, it was a coin toss. We were pretty buoyant at the time, given where we were in that kind of cycle of Conservatives in the Northeast. And then the first round came out, which is something that's often missed in Teesside as part of the evolution of the Red Wall, etc. But we won the first round of that election. That was when we knew it was done, because in Teesside, it is still the case today, you either vote Labour or you vote for somebody who's going to beat Labour.
Yeah.
So the fact that Labour couldn't win round one meant it was impossible for them to win round two. And when you actually look, I won comfortably every single council on round two because we swept up the UKIP and the Lib Dem vote, who'd obviously voted for their candidates in round one. So, yeah, it evolved over time. But for those senior ministers who said some very choice things about the likelihood of me winning was impossible, you know, it didn't feel like that on the ground. And we were trying to feed that back, but at the time, you know, you remember the context of where we were, it was an unlikely thing, but...
No, I remember around the time being asked about that and sort of saying that his value was a bit, firstly, a bit of a dark horse in terms of getting itself into the devolution agenda, because that wasn't really where Osborne was focusing. As you say, he was thinking about that, you know, the Northern powerhouses, he was thinking about which meant those different places, and yet his value came up. And then obviously, particularly given the politics at the time, the likelihood of a Conservative winning there was a long shot. What was it that the public told you that, why did they vote for you? What is it that you offered them that made them choose you?
The airport.
What they said to you? Is it the airport?
It was the airport. I mean, let's not overcomplicate it. There was no kind of complicated policy agenda that we cut through with.
No, quite.
You've got to think in Teesside, which is why it's a parochial issue, but it's so important, is that the success and failure or the natural decline of Teesside going back over the last 30 years with its peak and then its slight decline, strangely enough, follows the relative success and then the decline of the airport. So I'm very confident that there is a conscious and in some instances a subconscious link between the success of the area being linked with the success of the airport, and people see those two things as one and the same. It's a bit like the local high street argument that we see with the Towns Fund at the minute. If you feel like your high street's full of shops and it looks like a nice place to be and you can go and spend some money and you can see independent shops, you feel like the area's a bit on the up. And the airport encapsulates that for Teesside. And if you go back to the early 2000s when it kind of peaked at just over 1 million passengers, then Peel came in and you just saw this gradual decline, that was kind of Teesside. I mean, the early 2000s, even up to kind of 2006, 2007, we didn't get the economic boom of the Blair years that other areas felt across parts of the country that felt that economic boom. And you actually look at the election outcomes that Labour have had since 1997, they've gone back at every single election, local and national, in Teesside since 2005, local, national and European. Yeah. So it was a gradual ebb away. And then you had all sorts of things like Brexit. You had a bit of UKIP as that kind of, people say, that gateway drug into voting for somebody else other than what your father and your grandfather and your great-grandfather voted for. And we thought that was going to be the tipping point in 2017. But it wasn't Brexit that made the break, because that was still a UKIP angle. It wasn't anything else. It was the airport that just... I mean, and that's one of the reasons we ran it as well, because when we first came up with the policy, that was also a wedge issue that we were preparing for, because we knew how important it was. It was a wedge issue for the election, because if I wasn't going to win, we knew we were going to fight a mayoral election on me trying to save it and Labour basically saying it's a waste of money, it should close, which was going to cause Labour a problem. Because if I hadn't bought the airport would have closed by when the next election was due to be.
Right.
So we were planning 3 or 4 years ahead with that campaign. It just meant that, you know, I was walking into local housing estates, like places like Ingleby Barwick in Stockton that people wouldn't necessarily know. And we only spent £8,000 on my whole campaign. One leaflet that we were trying to hand deliver across the whole of the Tees Valley. And you were knocking on doors in Ingleby Barwick, and people were naturally saying, I'm voting for the guy that's going to save the airport. I mean, it sounds, speaking about it, from anybody that's not from the area, a little bit weird.
Yeah.
But you've got to come to Teesside to just understand how... And even now, I mean, I've been giving hints and tips to the Labour Party recently. Just stop talking about the airport. For every time you say it's a waste of money and we shouldn't have it and there are more important things, you're just losing more votes. You just let it go. Just understand that that is something that people in Teesside want to see happen, and let's have a conversation about other things that are equally as important.
Even if, you know, retrospectively now, where we are now, it didn't make sense, or the airport, you know, doesn't go the way that you would want, you are not forced, but you would be expected to deal with it rather than to say I made a mistake.
That's not quite right. Okay. So when I was elected, obviously, this is something that people often forget on the journey that we've been on in the Tees Valley, that, you know, we've done lots of successful things, but people forget for the first 18 months, it didn't matter what I did. And there was, you know, in the early days, we were just getting up and running, but we did lots of good stuff in the early days. Yeah. And I would stand on, you know, local TV, local radio, local Gazette, and they'd be like, oh, that's great, Ben, but when are you buying the airport?
Yeah.
And the thing that changed everything for me, and this again, it sounds really weird, sat in a room full of people who are not from Teesside, trying to help you understand the local parochial nature of this issue. But the thing that everything changed for Tees Valley was when we actually bought the airport, because one, it created a link with the electorate that had been severed for a long, long time, because there have been lots of broken promises for years, both national and in local government, where we're going to do X, and all these shiny pictures were produced, and everybody said, oh, this is great, we're going to invest X into whatever, and it never actually happened. And what you had was, I benefited from, there was a lack of cynicism in my view of them saying, oh, we're going to back this guy who wants to buy the airport. Yeah. They kind of gave me the benefit of the doubt. Yeah. And then when I bought it, it just changed the whole credit. It was credibility just changed completely, because you got to a point where, and we still hear it now, they say, look, if Ben says he's going to do something, he does it. Yeah. So we'll give him the benefit of the doubt. And there are very few in Teesside for a lot of years that have been able to say that. And that's all predicated on the airport. All of the work we're doing on the Freeport, the SSI Redcar Steelworks redevelopment is going to take 15 years. It's a bit like the conversation that government are having at the minute about Northern Powers Rail levelling up.
Yeah.
You know, to change and do what we want to do is going to take 15, 20 years. But you've got to be able to do some quick wins that signpost people that you are making progress. People can't buy into a 10, 15, 20-year vision without seeing at least some progress. You give them progress, yeah, though, and people are really willing to buy into it. That's the cynicism in politics at the minute, that there are so few that do what they say they're going to do. You just give them you just show a little bit of leg, and people will go with you on it, and then it allows you the time to be able to develop the longer-term plans.
And presumably, as part of that kind of early wins, you're having to rightly identifying issues that have a symbolic nature. You know, you talked about the airport one. Mm-hmm. Steelworks in the future of, obviously, is a massive issue in your part of the world as well. So even though it might take 15, 20 years, they are symbolic issues that people want to know that you're not ignoring them and trying to do something else, because they are so important. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. So again, the Tees Work site is an equally important one. It's what was originally a 25-year plan. I think we'll end up delivering it in somewhere between 10 and 12 years now with the progress that we're making. But you can't say to someone, right, we're going to create 20,000 jobs on this steelwork site in 25 years. They can be like, oh, that's great, but your average person in the street is going to be like, yeah, I believe that when I see it.
Yeah.
So again, what we've had to do is we've had to signpost it. So, you know, we're doing a lot of communication with the public to show that the site's being cleared, demolition is happening, remediation's going on. You know, just last week we started construction, the first piece of construction after actually nearly 12 months of owning the site, but, you know, 6 years since the SSI site closed in 2015. Yeah. You're now starting in the construction phase now, so people can start to, rather than demolition and clearance, you're now seeing building, positive activity. So last week was that first step with the new heavy lift quay. It started construction last week. In 4 or 5, maybe 6 weeks' time, if we're a bit slow, the new GE offshore wind factory is going to start being built. So again, you move into another phase. I was even surprised a few weeks ago. I was speaking to some people in Redcar, and there is a level of cynicism about, you know, a few people are still saying you can tell they don't quite believe the GE thing's actually going to happen.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you're so close to it, because you're negotiating the deal and you're dealing with funders, et cetera, you take it as a given, but you sometimes forget the public just see another headline in a piece on a paper. Whereas in 5 weeks, again, it's a bit like the airport, it'll change again. You'll see piles going in the ground, you'll see steel structures, steel beams going up for the construction of it. And again, that's going to help us build even more credibility on another project that isn't the airport, that says, actually, it's not finished yet. And yes, it's going to take 20 years, but the factory is being built, construction jobs are being created. These things are actually happening.
Yeah. And one of the other projects, from outsiders, I've noticed you talked quite a bit about, is about Darlington Station and the connection, you know, improving the capacity of it, but actually therefore making the connections, you know, out to parts outside of the region. Is that another kind of symbolic thing that resonates with people? And, you know, it has an importance, but it also resonates with the public.
It resonates with people that don't even use trains.
Yeah.
And it's because it's a bit like the levelling up agenda. It's an investment in somewhere that has felt left behind for a long, long time. And it's just that feel-good factor that we're no longer an afterthought. And, you know, 5 years ago, you know, I can tell you civil servants couldn't have pointed to Teesside on a map. Whereas now, civil servants are always asking us, what do you think? I mean, they're actually asking us, what do we think about various things? What do we think about levelling up? So things change very, very quickly. And it's the same on a local level. So people see that, you know, lots of people don't get the train, but they see an investment in Darlington as a positive move forward, because it's money, it's the government caring, it's actually something bigger than Teesside actually happening here. And it's a really important part of devolution. I know we've talked about in previous years, Andrew. It's a really important part of devolution. We talk about Darlington Station, but the people of Hartlepool and Redcar buy into the investment as well. Because
yeah.
We're all, you know, the devolved area is one, Teesside is one community. And so an investment in Darlington is an investment in the people of Redcar and Hartlepool and everywhere in between. But also you've got to be frank with people and explain why. I mean, investing in Darlington Station is great for Darlington. It'll be revitalised the local area. But it also means you can get up to 7 trains an hour on the local line instead of just 2 at the minute because of the impact on the rail alignment issues. So people can say, well, it's great having a shiny building, but actually it means for me in Middlesbrough. So I've had people in Redcar, nurses in Redcar, who work at James Cook, message me on social media and say, this is amazing because it means that now I find it extremely difficult to get to work and I can just jump on a train in a couple of months' time when TPE extended their service to Redcar and I can now go to work really easily. It saves me a fortune. I don't drive. And it's those little things. And that's people can see that investment in Darlington meaning that that's having an impact in Redcar. So it's just making sure that everybody feels joined up and understanding projects that resonate across the whole region and not being too... which is good because of our size, but not getting too down in the weeds on what councils do. Concentrate on the bigger things that impact regionally rather than the sub-regional things that only impact on a local authority.
So we've talked a little bit about some of those big things. What are the other big things that are on either underway or on your agenda for the next short-term period? What else are you...
So we've been relatively reserved on this. So we obviously did a huge amount over the last couple of years. We had a fantastic budget in March with the Chancellor, which we all now dub the Teesside budget, even if it's just locally. But it was. I mean, we've never heard a Secretary of State or a Chancellor ever speak in such glowing terms or be as favourable to Teesside as we've had in that budget, whether it be, the Freeport or the Treasury or whatever it might be coming to the region. And so what we're now focused on, again, going back to the point that I just made, it's great that the Chancellor announced a Freeport. It's great that we've announced the Treasury and DIT and others are coming to the area. It's great that we're doing all of these announcements, but it's relative. I'm always quite active on social media and in PR, but over the last 4 months since the election, we've just been concentrating as a team, both at the Development Corporation and at the Combined Authority, make sure we get these things delivered. Don't go backwards from the last 4 years' goodwill we've built up with the public. We don't have to promise another shiny thing. We don't have to promise another massive project that's similar to the Freeport. Just deliver the Freeport. Just deliver GE. Just deliver the Treasury and make sure it works. You don't have to pull up trees to please the public. You just need to be competent and deliver. And like you said, just because Rishi's made an announcement doesn't mean the next year you need another box office announcement. Yeah. People need to feel the tangible benefits because like you say, last week's newspaper is this week's chip paper. And that's the same in local communities. They've heard it all before. They need to see the tangible differences on the ground. So that's what we've been concentrating on.
Yeah, and if I can be just your reflection, because you said it, so I'm just going to say what you said, but the focus on the tangible, unless you were misquoted, which I don't think you were, you had something in the press earlier on about you were slightly critical of some of your mayoral colleagues, that maybe they weren't as diligent and as practical as maybe you were. I mean, just your thinking behind that?
If you watch the podcast or read or listen to the podcast, I think there is a video of it as well. If you listen to the context of it, it is more nuanced than that. But it is also fair to say that sometimes other mayoralities and other mayors concentrate a little bit too much on the politics rather than the delivery side. And I just made the gentle inquiry of Rob Parsons, who's a fantastic journalist, who's doing a Northern Powers stuff at Reach. I just made the gentle assumption that he might want to inquire of what people originally set out to do in their 17 manifesto. And see actually how much progress they've made. Because it's an interesting one for devolution, because it doesn't necessarily... So counter to my argument, because it's just the way I am, there are other mayoralities that I personally don't think have delivered on their pledges and manifestos and done as much as they could be doing, but their vote shares have gone up. So there are other ways of being a Metro Mayor, actually. And one of the really powerful ways that we all saw with Andy Burnham, all credit to him, he handled it extremely well, especially, 4 or 5 days after he was elected with the Manchester bombings. Yeah. Bringing communities together. So sometimes it's not always about the physical. I think it is in the long term, but often it's about being a symbolic thing or a person or a representative that just embodies a community at the time. And you don't get that, I don't think, with normal local authorities because local authority leaders aren't high profile. Nobody really knows who they are. You've in effect, through a regional mayor, you have a directly elected person who has a level of gravitas that that can speak on behalf of the public. And as long as they get the tone right, in the same way that Andy got it perfectly right and responsibly with the Manchester attacks, that in itself can really help a mayor succeed in a different way to maybe that we've tackled it in Teesside. I mean, he does get away with murder sometimes, though, doesn't he? Let's be honest.
He's, he's a politician.
I know he does, but I mean, God, he gets an easy ride.
Far be it for me to say, but you chance your arm as well, would you not?
Absolutely. Yeah. No,
you're kind of making hay.
And I appreciate the feedback.
What I'm suggesting is that, we're
all at it. We're all politicians, aren't we? Of course we are, Andrew. Of course we are. And I must say, just to put out a concept, because I have some kind of, not from Andy, I've not spoken to Andy for a while. I've had to explain myself to people. I have a good relationship with Andy Burnham. And I spent early doors, I spent a lot of time with Andy and Steve Rotherham, neither of which I'd ever met before. Genuinely nice people, on a personal level, can't fault them. They're both people that you'd actually quite like to go to the pub with. Yeah. But, we're always going to have disagreements. That doesn't mean we don't get on. It doesn't mean that Andy's not trying to do the best for the people of Manchester. But, that's politics. We do things in different ways.
Indeed. Very good. Very good.
Was that diplomatic enough?
That is very diplomatic. Okay. I appreciate that. So you've used the term a couple of times. We had a session actually this morning here. Andy Street was with us. Mm. And we were talking a little bit about, what levelling up means. And he was saying, you think about your agenda, his agenda. That's levelling up before the government really coined the phrase in many respects, or at least what's required in your rare is that. So just help us out, in terms of help the government out maybe. Yep. How do you interpret and make real levelling up? I mean, what does it mean for you and for the Tees Valley?
So,
notwithstanding what the government thinks, I'll ask you that in a second, but what does it mean for you and for Tees Valley?
Yeah, I'll give you my thoughts, because sometimes when I talk about this, I can also understand that you can probably pick apart my words and maybe I contradict myself a little bit, but fundamentally, I get slightly irritated with people that try to define levelling up as anything, because it's not anything. So people try and define it in terms of a cause that they're already passionate about. Yeah. And proper phase one levelling up was originally about the North. I mean, we don't really talk about the Northern Powers anymore, do we? It's not really a phrase the government used. Boris turned it into the levelling up because actually, and this is something that I think I've mentioned to you before, and I'm sure you guys would maybe slightly disagree with, I don't know. But I actually see levelling up as more of a towns and villages and rural, semi-rural areas, not versus, but in parallel to cities. Okay. And you often find a lot of the left-behind areas are non-metropolitan city areas. And that's why the government talk about levelling up, because actually, as I've just been at an event, some of the similar problems and poverty and deprivation we have in Teesside and the connectivity issues we have are the same in Cornwall. And you can speak to a lot of angry Conservatives in the south of England who rightly say that they face similar problems as well. So levelling up is actually a thing. Phase one, yes, it's largely based on the north of England. And phase one is largely infrastructure, it's physical. And it's why Boris likes levelling up, because he's an infrastructure guy, and he likes building big things. And the reason for that is if you go to, and I'll use Teesside again, but you can probably take Stoke or Bolton or parts of Sunderland and Gateshead, maybe less so Gateshead because it's doing reasonably well, but could always do with more. These are areas that have never seen any real investment for decades. Governments of both colours. And so when we talk about, and again, Andy's right to bang the drum in Manchester, because I'd be doing the same thing if I was him, but asking the government for £1 billion to make a London-style transport system is for the birds in Teesside, because we're not even at the starting line for that. I mean, I've got large areas of East Cleveland that are as rural as it gets anywhere in the country who don't even have a bus. So having that conversation with government is a non-starter with us, and it's areas like that that level one of levelling up is about. It's about getting everybody to the starting line, so at least they're in with a shout. And then phases two, you can start to nuance, and I think you nuance phase two of devolution phase two of levelling up through devolution, because what levelling up at that stage means to Manchester or Teesside or Newcastle or Liverpool or Leeds is different in every place. Yeah. But levelling up also on a broader scale is fundamentally about jobs and investment, because those things lead to the things that Michael Gove talked about, which is pride in place, better connectivity, opportunities that where you can still live and build a career and have a life in the area that you grew up in, rather than having to get up and go away. Yeah. All of that fundamentally comes down to more investment and more job opportunities in the regions.
So I completely agree with, I might quibble with you a little bit on the cities and towns and villages.
Yeah, I can understand that. Yeah.
Well, I completely agree with you, irrespective of the geography question, completely agree with you on the jobs and the economy focus.
Yep.
Why does the government find it so hard to say that?
So
they were partly to these conversations. Why is it but they almost fall over backwards not to be explicit about the jobs and the employment.
Because I think
it's a bit of everything.
Because I think they want to get it right. So what you're going to see in the Levelling Up white paper, is it even? It might even be the end of this month.
Apparently around the spending review.
Apparently so. Apparently so. Right. So in the next few weeks, it's going to come. Yeah. There will be metrics in the white paper. And I think that's the one thing, because it allows people to get away from what does it mean, how are we judging you on Levelling Up. There are going to be some metrics. And I think, to be fair, I don't know, because I've not seen that level of detail. Yeah. I've just given my advice and feedback. But I think you can probably guess from what Boris has said in the last few days, yeah, you know, wage growth is a big thing. Yeah. So that's going to lead to jobs. So that's going to look at, you know, average wage in the Tees Valley, 24 grand, national average 31. Yeah. You know, is there going to be a metric in there that talks about trying to get these areas up to at least the national average over a certain period of time? I think you probably will end up getting there.
Would you encourage them to go down that route? You know, to be, A, as you said, focus on jobs and employment, economy-related kind of focus. Secondly, to have some of those metrics that are pegging places to, you know, to something else and giving them some, you know, some target to aim for.
I would like to. It'll be interesting to see on what geography they try and define those metrics on, yeah, whether it's a UK-wide geography. I honestly don't know. But, I mean, ultimately, you need to set yourself some hard targets, because that gives you the focus to deliver on what you're actually trying to achieve. If it's nebulous, then, you know, you can get away with anything, can't you? We're politicians, so we'll always use it to get away with anything. So the harder the metric, the better. So we'll see. Yeah, we'll see. I don't know. It'll come. But I'm pleased that they're coming up with metrics. I'm pleased that they're moving forward with more English devolution, looking at county deals, looking at trying to get everywhere across the country represented by a devolution deal. I think, and I've made my representations very clear to government, that I think that needs to come with a mayor. I'm still a believer in Osborne's view that if you want a devolution deal, you've got to have a mayor, because some in the policy units in government sometimes don't quite get the intangible thing that a mayor brings, irrespective of the personality, but the role itself comes with a standing that I think is more powerful than people have realised. So county deals just to counties that just in effect give them slightly more money and more power, I think would be a big missed opportunity.
Yeah, and I won't know for questions very shortly. Andy Street was saying this morning, Andy Burnham was saying it yesterday and last week, you know, they're back into government for Devo Deal 3 or the next, you know, a next deal. They're, you know, they have their asks. Have you got, are you in the similar space, or in a sense, are you comfortable with what you've got, and now the question is delivery for you over the next period?
So it's interesting. It depends on what you mean by further devolution. So asks are different to devolution. So we're all the combined authority areas are currently having lengthy discussions about transport settlements at the minute, which is the thing that Andy was talking about the other day for the £1 billion. So that's more of an ask than a next step in devolution, because really it's funding to be able to put in the infrastructure for transport that you want, which I think is largely the conversation. There are a couple of conversations that Andy Street's having around.
Particularly when something on skills.
And I think with Michael Gove in particular, I get the impression when I've spoken to Michael quite a lot recently since being appointed as Secretary of State, the door seems to be much more open to further devolution of skills than it ever has been before. Right. Now, whether that materialises or not, but you can tell that, I'm just picking this up from Michael, it's definitely something that's percolating in his mind that there is something around skills, and obviously Andy Street's bent his ear about it. But from our point of view, and again, it's part of the representations I've made to government on the Levelling Up white paper, for existing devolution deals, I think we've got to get the devolution deals we have in place right first. Now, that's not saying we shouldn't have more powers, but I think the powers that we should be asking for are about deeper powers and entrenchment of what we've already got that go further, rather than just saying, right, I've got economic development now, so now I want health, or now I want public health, or now I want control over everything that Homes England have in my area. Yeah. I think if you broaden too quickly, you become a bloated bureaucracy, you lose focus. And the one thing that actually all combined authorities are doing relatively well is understanding the focus of the mission. Yeah. As soon as you add more diverse powers, you become a pseudo-local authority where you're having to fight children's services, fill in potholes, help with regeneration where you can. You can't do that as an organisation. So focus is what's right. Obviously, other mayors will be asking for more than that, but my view is there. But I also think as well, minor criticism of others, you take examples. They want more, you know, other mayors want more money. We all want more money. But they're more overt about saying, I want more money, I want more powers, because I've not been able to do enough. But again, it's kind of the thing that got me into trouble with the Rob Parsons podcast, was just go away and have a look at what they've already done with the powers and the money they've got. Okay. And the great example of that is the Transforming Cities money. Yeah. And for those that don't know, the Transforming Cities money is in effect money that was allocated by the government a couple of years ago that was automatically given on a per head of population basis to combined authority areas. And obviously, depending on how big you were, you obviously got a lot more money. We got about 80 million quid because obviously we're the smallest area, or we were at the time. We are the only combined authority area that are on track to spend the money in the timescales that were agreed and set out with government. Every other combined authority area is asking for extensions from the government for the money because they're not spending the money as quickly as they should have done as they originally intended. So, and I don't know the reasons for that. I'm sure there are some perfectly good explanations for it. But not knowing the detail, my general question was, well, maybe we should think about making sure we're spending the money that we've got first rather than continuing to ask for more when you can't even spend what you've got. And again, there may be some legitimate reasons for that, but I think we've got to look at that very carefully before we just say, here's a load more money, because again, you get into that issue of expectation. Yeah, let's say I get a billion quid, never mind Andy. You know, it's great having a billion quid, but are you using it to the effect to benefit people? Yeah. Or are you just going to disappoint people even further by not delivering on the outcomes that you're then able to set?
Yeah, very good. Two more quick questions. One, you touched on it already, but is Michael Gove good? Is that good news for the Levelling Up and our devolution agenda?
Well, I think I'm probably the last mayor to say that, yes, I think he is. I mean, everybody so far has said that he's going to be good news. I mean, whatever you think of Michael, and I appreciate people outside the Conservative Party have certain views of him, largely from his education days and all the rest of it, but he is a reformer.
Yeah.
You can't deny that he was able to break the blob that was DfE. For ill or for good,
yeah,
he did it.
Yeah.
You know, that's, I think one of the things that we all looked at as mayors, irrespective of party, was we all pricked our ears up and were like, okay.
Interesting.
It sounds like Boris is really serious. You know, you don't put Michael in charge of that type of department unless you really want him to shake it up.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty excited. I don't know where it's going to go, but I think there are going to be some serious changes and additions to devolution. And I don't think there are many other ministers that could do it, but Michael's definitely one of them.
Last question. Maybe it's slightly unfair, but you know, you could just ignore me, so it's fine. And I appreciate you've only just been elected second term. Third term?
I have an answer, Andrew.
I've rehearsed
the answer many times before.
I'm not the first person to ask you. No. I'm sure you've got a fully versed. But, third term, MP,
Yeah, I plan to stand for a third term.
Right.
I mean, it is, hand on heart, the best job I could ever possibly wish to have. And again, it all sounds a bit cliched and a bit sickly, but, you know, even if I don't get elected next time round, to have what will have been 7 years of this has been the privilege of a lifetime. And, you know, if I get re-elected again, fine. If I don't get re-elected, fine. If something happens in the meantime and I'm not able to stand, or, you know, government does an about turn and abolishes all devolution, I'll be very happy with what I've done over the last 7 years.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre4Cities, or like us on LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.